Hello, Pitt. Welcome to my podcast.
Hi, John. Nice meeting you.
So I think you have a very interesting background concerning the history of Luxembourg. And I think this might actually be quite interesting for a lot of my audience, because I think a lot of my audience is comprised of expats who might not know exactly what the history of Luxembourg is. And you have done quite a substantial amount of work in that area. But first, I would like to know how you got into this line of work, as you would describe, I think, yourself as a historical consultant or history consultant.
Right. Now, quite a few people, I think, have had kind of similar experience of discovering history as a passion quite an early age. And so that clearly was the case for me. I mean, I knew from childhood that history was something I felt really passionate about. And so I did that. I mean, I followed the passion, I studied history. I kind of got stuck for a while at university, up to the point of realizing that how hard the academic job market is. And so I just started off setting up my own business. And I now run a company called Historical Consulting. And we do a lot of public history projects, exhibitions, brochures, all sort of things.
So your clients, are they mostly state, or there's private businesses, or what does that normally look like?
A bit of each, but I think the largest chunk of our turnover is public money. So it could be state institutions, but also municipalities, university, that kind of thing.
So when did you discover your interest in researching the history of Luxembourg? Was that during the studies? Was that after the studies? So when did that moment come?
So I did most of my studies in Edinburgh in Scotland, which gave me a considerable distance. I could have gone further, obviously, but it gave me a certain distance and attachment from Luxembourg, which I think was important in quite a few ways. But it also allowed me to revisit Luxembourg's past from that distance, from a new perspective. And so I think another crucial bit is that I was actually asked to join one of the very first research projects in history at the University of Luxembourg, which was basically, a revisiting of that, of Luxembourg's past. It mainly resulted in something you could call it a deconstruction of the existing way of telling Luxembourg's past, telling Luxembourg's history. So that's kind of how I got into this. And I think the result of it, I think some of which you know, there are a couple of books that came from this, one called Inventing Luxembourg. Another one I penned myself called Constructing the Middle Ages, which is about the position of the Middle Ages in Luxembourg's vision of its own past. These are all very academic things. Another bit I was asked to produce only a few years ago by the Luxembourg government was a short history of Luxembourg. And that was an interesting exercise because I kind of had to do the opposite. Like, after spending about 10 years of my career demolishing Luxembourg's history and just sort of saying what everything was wrong about it, I kind of had to do the opposite and say, like, well, what do we do? What can emerge from this rubble? And so what's still true? And how shall we maybe tell Luxembourg's history today?
Because you mentioned the negative part, I guess, is when you said you discovered some parts of Luxembourg's history that may not be communicated to the public as much as it should have been. But the one point that I think is most interesting is, if I could quote that, is that you said that Luxembourg's national identity was invented rather than organically developed. So what do you mean by it was invented? Maybe you can elaborate on that a bit.
There are a few things here which I think are crucial to stress. The first one is every identity is constructed. So this is not just identities in Luxembourg. It's not just national identity. Every identity is, in a sense, well, first of all, constructed. And when it comes to the elements that make up or that people identify with in Luxembourg, and sorry for making this sound very complex and complicated, but within their sort of national identification, within their national identity. Now, these elements, of course, they didn't just emerge from anywhere. These elements had to be presented as such. I mean, people believe that the way they feel as belonging to a community, never mind which community this is, you know, these can be very different, very various communities. They think that this just happened, that this is who they are. I mean, that's what we generally mean in a very naive way with identity. But no, it's generally these are elements that have been made. And the book Inventing Luxembourg, it's about three such elements. It's the past, it's space, and it's language.
So who decides how this national identity is communicated to the people?
How it's communicated? Well,
how is it developed? How did Luxembourg develop its national identity? How does that work in practice?
How does it work in practice? Well, and again, I'm just stressing Luxembourg's not an exception in that sense.
You know? Sure, other countries do it too, right?
Processes that you find pretty much everywhere,
and
so the first thing you need is an entity with which people should identify. And in when we talk about national identities, and again, I'm just repeating myself, but it's just one type of identity, and we all have multiple identities in that mm-hmm. sense. You know, we different levels, different communities we belong to. It could even be our family, our generation, mm-hmm. sports club, you know, name it. But so when it comes to national identity, of course, a national identity is, in a sense, the ideology of a state. So first you need a state. I mean, quite a lot of people think that national identity comes first, and based on this, people kind of want to create the state. And research in the past decades has inversed this. They say, like, well, no, actually, it's generally that there is a state, and the state makes it creates its national citizens. And the means by which this traditionally happened, I mean, just the big ones, and now, of course, in Luxembourg, the proportion to which these were important, of course, specific, and this can vary from one place to another. But so you have the army, mm-hmm. which is one thing, which in Luxembourg is maybe played less of a role, but you have the army. You have education, like mm-hmm. you have one national curriculum in mm-hmm. which a vision of what this nation should be is being promoted. And the next element is media.
So the three pillars of how national identity is created is military, education, and media.
So this is basically how it's being transmitted to the public, the audience. You know,
okay.
How is it created? Well, you have actors who participate in this. They discover that this is actually quite a cool thing. They're very much convinced of being part of the nation because it legitimizes their state, it legitimizes independence, it explains why it has a reason to exist and why it may be old and unique and special and all that. Mm-hmm. And so this generally starts with intellectual elites, political elites, which if it comes to the 19th century, particularly 19th century Luxembourg, these are the same people.
Mm-hmm. What is the element of Luxembourg's history in this, right? I think you wrote about this in your book as mm-hmm. well. Mm-hmm. I say we because I'm from Luxembourg as well, right? So I was mm-hmm. speaking of identity. So we have been under different sovereignty, different rule, and we've been split and reconquered and conquered and transferred so much to different states and countries, right? So how does that play into the process of us finding an identity? Because I think that because we were so fragmented over different periods of time, there's a vacuum, right? It's like, okay, what is our identity? Are we French? Are we Spanish? Are we Dutch?
Right.
So how does that play into this?
So two things. First of all, and now I shall be deconstructing you.
Oh, very good. Please do.
But if you use the word we, you're ready, like, presuppose an existing community.
Yes. Like, I consider myself part of this community.
But that's what you're saying. You're not saying the community exists. You're saying I feel as mm-hmm. being part of a community. You're kind of expressing your identification with that community.
Yes.
The second thing you gave me just now is basically historical narrative. Mm-hmm. And it is a very biased one, because I would very much question what you've just been said. I do not think Luxembourg was fragmented and split and ruled by foreigners.
Oh, you don't?
I fundamentally oppose it. What you're basically giving me is a national vision of Luxembourg's past, which historical research has been questioning for the past 60 years.
So are you saying that I am recounting or retelling the story that other people have told, but that's actually not rooted in? Well, now I would know. I would like to know what is what actually happened. Let's get to the bottom.
I'm glad we have 24 hours to solve this, because that's the minimum I need
All right. Let's try to stay at the main points. All right.
Good. I'll try to explain a different way. Rather than giving you a different account, let's first explain why you may have this story in your head that you have in your head.
Yeah, yes, that would be interesting.
and then let's move on from there. So it's not like Luxembourg's never had any historians in the past. No, I mean there've been historians dealing with the past of political entities called Luxembourg since at least the 16th century, but with the emergence of an independent political state in the 19th century. And this links straight back to what I've just said. I mean, the stake became a different one. In the 19th century, history, and again, this happens everywhere in Europe, history is being used to legitimize the state. And so what you have is historians who reinterpret the past in a way that it explains why, in this case, Luxembourg should exist, and why it should remain independent. Because that's the big thing that politically was at stake. This political independence of Luxembourg was contested again and again. And it's only since the end of the Second World War that, at least for now, we've had a bit of stability in that kind of question. And so what these historians do is they react to this feeling of being politically under threat. And so what they do is they construct a history which answers to this. And the first thing they say is, well, Luxembourg's old. It has a very long, old past. It was founded in the Middle Ages.
Yes, in 963,
That's what you say.
Yeah.
And that, of course, gives, you know, that basically tells people, well, you know, it's been there for a very long time, so it should continue to exist. Like, why would you get rid of something that's been there for that long? Mm-hmm. It's as old as Germany and France and all the other places, so obviously it has the same kind of legitimacy.
Okay.
That's the first message. The second message is, well, but then it was ruled by all these foreigners, so it's gone undergone this period of hardship, which is yet another reason why it should have become independent,
yes,
in the 19th century, and therefore should keep this independence. But again, it's a story. It's a great story. It's a good story. But,
yeah, it feels good.
It feels good.
Yeah, it's clean narrative. You feel comfortable with it. Yes, it gives you some sort of pride.
Absolutely. And so,
yes.
But of course, one of the underlying thing is, for there to have been foreigners oppressing Luxembourg, there would have had to be Luxembourgers as well.
Yes.
So implicitly, the story tells you there have always been Luxembourgers.
They've always been there since the Middle Ages. Yeah.
Exactly. No, but that's what the story says.
Yes.
And again, it sounds great. And it gives you reason to, you know, argue in favor of political independence. But then if you look at the research that's taking place, like, we have no evidence that people felt like Luxembourgers before the 19th century, even before 1900. I need to relevate this a little bit, but still, you know, there's no feeling of a national community before that date, before it's being constructed in the 19th century. And likewise, people back then did not feel like living under foreign oppression. They thought that their Habsburg rulers, the Habsburg dynasty ruled Luxembourg for the longest. Nobody ever told you, but these are probably the most, in that sense, most legitimate dynasty there is. And okay, don't tell the Grand Duke, but these people weren't considered foreign. They didn't consider themselves foreign here either, not least because conceptions of being foreign and being a national were just very different in that time.
Mm-hmm. So just if I understand you correctly, you're saying that the concept of being a Luxembourger didn't really emerge until the 20th century, around the second end of the 19th century, if I understand you correctly.
So you have, I mean, it's a gradual process. I mean, you have people for the first time kind of starting to believe in the viability of the state from the 1840s, but not everyone. Even sometimes the prime minister wouldn't believe in the dependence of the long-term independence of the state. And so they're kind of building on top of that. And of course, we're talking about elites who had an interest in promoting that vision. Mm-hmm. And by the time it started trickling down, I mean, we're well into the 1860s. And by the time we really have all these elements coming together of how people should imagine themselves as being part of the Luxembourg nation, we're at the time of the First World War.
So if I ever get into a conversation with somebody and he asks me about the history of Luxembourg, then I should not tell him, no, we've always been there since the Middle Ages, but we're actually a relatively young nation, I guess, in that sense. And then also I want to parse apart, or I want to distill maybe the two elements, which is being a Luxembourger, so having the Luxembourgish nationality and the Luxembourgish language. So how are those tied together? Because obviously language is an important part of the nationality.
So I'll take these two bits apart. Mm-hmm. I mean, the first one is, and I'm just repeating myself, everything I'm saying about Luxembourg is very, very similar elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So not only is the Luxembourg nation a young nation, but so are all nations in Europe. I mean, you have some context, take Bohemia, take maybe the Netherlands, I mean, what was today the Netherlands, where you may be able to trace back ideas of national communities a bit further back into the past, but mm-hmm. they mean a different thing. So the moment when this kind of idea of national community spreads throughout society, touches all layers of society, and becomes this kind of thing that ties society together vertically, like from the lower class to the political elite. That's something only happening in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And so Luxembourg's not different from that. I mean, even the French had to be made. Mm-hmm. Even the Germans had to be made. And that goes with the Italians and the Brits and so on and so on.
So I don't want to maybe highlight my ignorance here, but aren't, for example, the Germans descending from a long line of history of the Franken before and everything? So isn't there a coherent line of at least the same people descending from the same? Doesn't that go back hundreds and hundreds of years?
It's a story.
That's also not true.
Well, I'm not saying that these stories aren't completely wrong. But I'm saying it's a story you're telling, and mm-hmm. it's a story that automatically excludes all sorts of other factors. There are different ways of telling the story. When it comes to, you've given the example of Germany, but it applies similarly to Luxembourg. What makes it complex is that you have a continuity of a name. Like, it's not like people didn't use the term German in the distant past. The thing is, what they meant with it is a very different thing than what we mean with it today. Mm-hmm. I mean, when we today say German, we think the Mannschaft, football, we think a certain flag, we see a certain language. It comes with all kinds of prejudices and biases about how they talk and behave and their obsession with precision and punctuality and so on and so on, which, of course, is all cliché. But that's not the connotations people would have back in the past. I mean, today, being German means being part of a nation state, or at least a state, which isn't what people, even in the 19th century, had a conception of German. I mean, in Luxembourg, you'd find a lot of people in the 19th century calling themselves German, mm-hmm. but meaning something very, very different. One of the problems, one of the things that facilitated the story you got in your head was the continuity of the name Luxembourg. Because obviously we can trace back this name to the 10th century. But then one of my points is it means something fundamentally different in the 10th century than it does mean today. And one of the techniques of this national story of Luxembourg is by just ignoring these differences. In fact, amalgamating all these different meanings of the name Luxembourg and thus creating a coherence, a continuity that I would very much question.
So maybe part of the confusion, because I'm reflecting on this now, is because we are so multilingual, right? So we speak Luxembourg, we speak French, we speak German. Right. So maybe in my head or in the national consciousness, we think, oh, it's because we were under German rule, we were under French rule, we were under Belgian rule. So maybe we think in some way, oh, all these things come together and that's why we speak so many languages, which I assume is wrong, but I'm just saying that might be the notion.
So I never answered your second question about language. The political entities called Luxembourg, and there were several. Mm-hmm. And there were moments when there was none, by the way, which again complicates the picture a little bit. But so the political entities called Luxembourg up to this stage, up to this day, have always been close to the Germanic Romance, German-French, if you want to simplify, language border. Mm-hmm. In fact, if you look at the historic Duchy of Luxembourg, the language border ran straight through it. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't an issue. Again, if we look at the historical evidence, people just, it was fine. And not least because language wasn't, there wasn't a national identity and language wasn't part of it either. So either way, people had a very pragmatic attitude towards languages in the past. It didn't play this role. As far as we can tell, as it does today. But that explains, this proximity explains why this multilingualism can be detected in Luxembourg from a very early stage. And with it comes the high prestige of French in the late Middle Ages. So what we have is basically a bilingual, if not even trilingual, if in fact they're in Latin, administration in Luxembourg since the Middle Ages, basically.
So you're saying that the multilingual aspect has been there since the Middle Ages, basically.
It's something which, at least originally, is just a reaction to, let's call it a practical problem. You know, it's not because people want to be multilingual. It's just because they need the languages and because it facilitates things. Mm-hmm. And it still does today, by the way. Mm-hmm. Now, the other thing, of course, is that, and that's why I absolutely love the language, that it shows you how, in the course of the 19th and 20th centuries, things became, please forgive of using the word in this context, but nationalized. Mm-hmm. The Luxembourg language was made as a standalone language, and as such became a self-fulfilling prophecy. So nowadays, obviously, if you cross the Luxembourg border across the Moselle into Germany, while people start speaking differently. Mm-hmm. When people first came up with the idea of a separate Luxembourg language, this was not the case. I mean, the self-fulfilling prophecy. So people say, we speak a different language. And the same happens, of course, in Germany as well. The same, like the Germans saying, we speak German. And with that, they mean High German, German.
Was the intention when people were deciding to create Luxembourgish to distinguish themselves from German, from French? Was that the intent behind, or what was the intent behind creating the Luxembourgish language?
So again, I said earlier on that the meaning of words change over time. Now, what does I even mentioned German in that context? So now, if you ask people in Luxembourg who speak the Germanic language, let's try to call it in that way, sure, in a very neutral sense. What language do you speak? They would probably say, we speak German. And with German,
I would say a dialect.
Not them. I'm not talking about Luxembourgers in 19th century Luxembourg.
Oh, okay.
So they would say, we speak German. And with that, they would mean, we speak the Germanic tongue of the people. Because that's the original meaning of German. Mm-hmm. In opposition to Romance, to French, to those languages, the Latin derivative languages. So that's the meaning of German. It's the language of the people, and it's the Germanic language of the people. And it doesn't come with these connotations of we now have to play football for the German national football team.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that changes as the German national football team came into experience. Sorry, I'm using the experience. So of course, this changes as Germany started to become a political reality. And it changed as this political reality of Germany became quite an aggressive neighbor. Mm-hmm. And it's especially after the First and Second World Wars that Luxembourgers thought something had to change. So even before, say, 1900, people would say, well, the language we speak, it's not just any kind of German, it's Luxembourgish German.
Mm-hmm.
That they would talk about our German on stage. This then became eventually Luxembourgish, mm-hmm. as being separate from German, given its own history, given its own linguistic reason why it should be separate from German. And of course, the comparison was made with what emerged at the time as the national language of Germany, which is standard German.
So basically, you're saying that the people that initially spoke Luxembourgish actually didn't think they were speaking Luxembourgish, but they were speaking German, in essence.
Yeah. But that's you looking at it retrospectively.
Mm-hmm.
So you're now using your conception of Luxembourgish, which is your today's conception of this, and you're looking at to analyze the past. We don't know what maybe people in 200 years think of Luxembourgish speakers and how they would label them.
Mm-hmm. I want to come back to the narrative because I think you're making a great point. I think whenever you communicate something to somebody, especially on a larger scale to a population, you want to use a coherent narrative, right? Which, as we discussed, makes you feel good. You know, maybe
if that's the ambition, yeah.
If that's it, wakes up some patriotic feelings. Yep. So I would imagine whenever those people decide to launch this narrative, they want to stay on the positives. But I think in your books and in your work, you also mentioned the negative or aspects that the narrative has silenced or that are not included in the narrative. Could you maybe explain a little bit what that means?
What that means is that the role of history has changed. The societal role of history has changed. I told you that the national narrative of Luxembourg was constructed at a time when the role of history was to legitimize the state, and it was used to basically, as you said, to make people feel good about themselves and everything and the situation.
So just a quick side note. So these efforts of transporting the narratives and inventing, as you said, the national identity was mostly after the Second World War, right? So that
It started before, roughly speaking. In our book, one example we're quoting, not as some people think the moment it started, but basically the moment it came all together, is a textbook, mm-hmm. published by the Luxembourg historian Arthur Herschen in 1918. But that basically brought all these elements together, elements which he and his predecessors had been developing over a couple of decades.
Mm-hmm.
So it's based on his teaching notes that he's probably used ever since the 1880s, 1890s. There is a slow emergence, but really, if you like to have the whole thing just squeezed into one coherent narrative, which then became, by the way, the school book on Luxembourg's history from 1918 all the way to the 1970. Just imagine. Mm-hmm. Well, that's it. That's the thing.
That's we have one source. That's it.
That's not one. But that's one example. For us, that's what's the best example of. But as I said, it's the culmination of a process.
Mm-hmm. So, but as you said, I think in your writings, we left out some things, especially around the Second World War, right?
No. So as I said, it's the purpose of history has changed because nowadays, of course, what we expect history to be is a critical social science. It's part of a critical academic subject. You know, history is no longer what makes or should make us feel good about ourselves, but at least from an academic point of view, it's something that should question what we're doing as a society. It should be a mirror, a critical mirror to what we do by confronting us in a critical way with our past. And so that's a crucial shift, because history is no longer about make us, the point isn't any longer to make us feel good about ourselves, but it's really to, rather to do the opposite, I'm exaggerating, but to question what we've done in the past and what that may mean for the future.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that, and again, this is not completely new. I mean, you've always had critical historians, obviously, but I think the general perception of what history should do has become a different one. And so that means that we now no longer, and this is also where history and memory kind of mix. Sorry, mm-hmm. but so if you look, for example, at the Second World War, and again, I'm simplifying hugely here, is that the country had to move on. The country had to present itself as having been on the good side of history. So it tells everybody, look, after having been victims of foreign oppression during the early modern period, 400 years of Habsburgs and so on, and the French and blah, blah, blah. Now, the same happened again now in the 20th century, and in came these evil Germans, which they were. And,
yes, and we did not and we did not support them whatsoever.
And no, and we were oppressed
completely us, oppressed, yes.
As a coherent yeah. national yes. community. And again, we mm-hmm. have this idea, which you mentioned earlier, as the Luxembourgers are, in Germany, you would say a Schicksalsgemeinschaft, like they're mm-hmm. a coherent group of people who march together through history
yes.
and have to
yes.
face all sorts of challenges, but always emerge from them victorious.
Yes.
And of course, again, you have the same kind of vision elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that story was not, I mean, the story had a purpose. It helped the country to move on, stay coherent, and sell itself to its allies, so to speak. I'm going to exaggerating slightly, but it helped it become a member of NATO and the UN and the European Union, etc., etc. But obviously, it doesn't show the whole complexity. Now, my point isn't that it was all wrong and that the opposite was true. But if we take a bit of a distance, what we see is that obviously people back then, they didn't know about the future. As the Germans marched into Luxembourg in May 1940, people had to take decisions. And what did they base the decision on? Well, they based them on previous experiences, notably the First World War, and they based them on what they expected to happen in the future, which, well, could well have been a German victory. And so basically they have three ways of reacting. The majority of the population waits for quite okay. a while. I mean, they don't like the Germans. There's the majority have a deep antipathy.
So look and see approach.
The foreign, yeah. yeah, but they have, they're really not in favor of a regime that's considered both foreign and totalitarian. Like they don't like either of this, but they don't quite know what's happening. And the second approach would have been to resist. And say, like, well, no, we're not having any of it. And we now, basically what the Ukrainians did the moment the Russians marched in February 22. But that...
Well, you can...
Yeah.
So I guess basically your two options are you can comply or you can resist.
Right, you could... Yeah, that's it. And so you could resist, but that was not really feasible. People mm-hmm. didn't think, well, what should it lead to, especially in that kind of situation? And the other one was not just to comply, but to actually to find this pretty cool what the Germans did. Because there was a positive vision here for some
okay.
people, you know.
So that's the third group who are actually, oh, this might actually be great, yeah.
And so what we see is that both those who actively collaborate and those who actively resisted were minorities. They were both, I don't know, generalized, like hugely, maybe 10% of the population. And so the majority of the population first waits, hedges its bets, tries to survive, just mangles through it. And I had ancestors, most of my ancestors were that way. They just tried to survive, you know, trying to deal with whatever they had to deal and not lose all their humanity in the process and see what happened. And what we notice is that resistance did increase considerably for two reasons. First, after the general draft of the Germans, like forcing all young men as conscripts into the German Wehrmacht. That was not a popular measure. But it also coincided with a turn at the front. Like it was after the Battle of Stalingrad, which showed, you know, suddenly the Germans were actually slowly on the retreat. So there was a possibility of thinking, well, actually, the Germans may not win. But still, the point is that the story, the very simplified story that Luxembourg has told themselves of the Second World War is we were all good. We were all resistant. We were fundamentally opposed to this from the start, and we emerged from it victorious. Mm-hmm. And of course, looking back at it, and again, there's nothing new. I mean, there's something historians have been doing for the past 50 years, but looking back at it in a more critical way, of course, is, well, it's more, you know, it's more complex. And no, there were people who thought that National Socialism was cool, and even in Luxembourg, and there were people who opposed it from the start, but also for varying reasons. You know, it's even the resistance is not homogeneous. It's that people for all kinds of borders, who there's staunch nationalists, there were communists, there were even anti-Semists who participated in this, but there were also like people like humanists and Christians and you name it, who resistant for various reasons to the German occupation.
Is that something that you think is severely underrepresented? Would you wish that in our public conversation we would bring up these more nuanced elements like you just described, right? Like this aspect of, no, we weren't all resisting to in the Second World War when the Germans came, but there were, you know, we were split into different groups, and no, it's more complicated than that. So is the conversation too simplistic for you in that sense?
So in this case, I think we have to differentiate between memory and history, or history and memory. So I've been now talking mainly about history, and history, of course, as I just said, is the critical stance you have to the past, your careful analysis, which you can present not only in sort of complex, heavy scholarly articles. Of course, you can also present it in much more everyday language that's accessible to huge variety of people. But still, that's history. But the way that the past is dealt with in the public sphere is mainly through what we could call memory. So it's through monuments, it's through speeches while talking at anniversaries, and it's not the historians giving the speech, it's the politicians giving the speech. And so what we have here is automatically a simplification of this picture. And in a way, it's fine, because that's what memory does and should do. And I mean, that's the way things work. But I think that the picture is becoming more complex over time. So if you say, should we not have a more complex kind of public discourse about all this? Well, it's happening.
But aren't other nations maybe doing a little bit of a better job dealing with their negative history? I mean, I can take a concrete example, like Germany. I think Germany is quite honest about its history, and, you know, is really conscious and careful to respect that history. So I guess that's the point I'm making, is that, you know, that I think it's important to, like you said, to be critical about its own history and not to whitewash it and present it as this rosy, you know, we've always been fighters, we've always been resistant, we've always been under foreign rule. And so why, I guess my question is, why is it that we're leaving out these things?
So who's leaving it out for which purpose? And I said, I mean, if you're in a context, in a memorial context, of someone, you know, giving a political speech in front of a monument, obviously they're simplifying things, because first, they can only speak for 10 minutes. Second, their point is to tell people why the monument is important and not to give some kind of, et cetera, et cetera. So this is natural. This is obvious.
Well, I guess
history is doing what you're saying. I mean, there has been a lot happening in academic history over the past decades, and all sorts of topics being spoken about that maybe a generation ago or two generations ago were mildly taboo or not, you know, not the thing you should do. So in that sense, I think a lot is happening. It's the issue is rather the trickling down, which isn't always working as well as it could.
Well, maybe we'll start with education.
Right.
Because, and I'm considering my own case, because I went through the school system here, and I think we had Luxembourgish or the language in like 1 year, and I think it didn't even count. At no point did I remember that we actually extensively talked about the history of Luxembourg. So this is not something that is even discussed in our curriculum. So maybe we start there, because that is part of, you know, young people, they start with the history and then they can learn it. So maybe there's already a problem there.
In a sense, there is. I mean, if you want to see there's a problem, I mean, you could, again, this maybe telling more about yourself than thing.
Well, but, yeah, not necessarily, but it's something that I noticed. It might not be a problem.
No, that's fine. So it's difficult to well, first of all, I'm not part of the educational system, so it's difficult for me to say what exactly is happening. But you're absolutely right that Luxembourg history is not really been part of the curriculum, and it's very much encouraged. But it very often starts with teaching staff complaining about not having the necessary resources. I mean, they don't really know where to start with Luxembourg history. They don't really know the past well enough. Since there is no textbook, it basically means they would have to gather all the information themselves, etc. So that's, and then again, they've been taught sometimes along the old narrative, so they didn't really know how to respond to changes in historiography. So I think there is a first crucial element happening. And so in the sense, that probably explains why Luxembourg history is a bit of a stepchild when it comes to the curriculum. It's not really, you know, it's not really being taken as seriously as it could, let's say. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, whether you find this good or not, it depends a bit on you.
Sure.
Now, one solution that you could take and that I would very much advocate is, but again, you need obviously the resources to do this, is to use Luxembourg history as a way to explain European history. Because, of course, what's happening in the past in Luxembourg are things that also happen elsewhere. It's becoming a recurring statement I'm making. So you can use Luxembourg. I mean, things happening here, whether it's the 10th century, whether it's 10th century before Christ, whether it's the 16th century, that are representative of European-wide phenomena that are currently taught by using examples from elsewhere, because that's where the textbooks come from. I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing, but I think the same could be done by using local examples. But I think the crucial bit is the lack of resources.
Another aspect, and this is quite important for my audience, is the rise or the emergence of social media. So how do you think that plays into communicating history? Do you think it might be advantageous that we can use online sources to actually promote a more accurate retelling of history? Or do you think it can also, it can be a problem because a lot of times there's no verification of sources? You know, there's a lot of information that might spread that might be inaccurate. So what do you think about how that has changed our relationship with history?
Well, first of all, I have to admit I'm not a social media person.
Sure, but I think nowadays we all kind of are. So
in a sense, it
kind of blends in together,
right? Yeah. But I just say it's yet another medium. Does it really change things? I'm not so sure. It's just it's changed where people get the information from. It changes who can provide information. But you know, it could go either way. I mean, it's a way, obviously, how the, let's call them, the old myths are continue to be spread. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if it wasn't social media, it'd be something else. So everything is an opportunity. Social media could be an opportunity to spread new visions of history. It just needs to be done, yeah.
Going back to the point of the reality and of the narrative or the reality of history and the narrative, right. Do you think that this gap is going to widen in the future? Is like there's going to be more distance between the narrative and the actual facts of history? Or do you think there's a way to close this gap and maybe get back closer to what is actually true rather than indulging in the narrative or the invented national identity, I guess?
I'm a bit afraid that this podcast episode would will is becoming a bit too academic. I'm not quite sure, but the point is, there is no such thing as historical reality outside of narrative. Narratives is all we have. I mean, even if we say, well, I'm now going to tell you the real history.
Oh, okay, but
it's still a narrative.
I just want to jump on that point because I've done my PhD as well, and obviously, whenever we empirically investigate a phenomenon, there's always going to be some variance and error. We cannot 100% know what the truth is. Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying is, I'm always saying there is an objective truth, right? Mm-hmm. Regardless of what that is. And we as scientists or academics, we try to get to be as close to that truth as possible. So I guess that was my point, is that like we want to be as accurate as possible when describing, as in your case, the history of our country, right?
So my view of history is a different one. I mean, what we have is our historical source material. Mm-hmm. So we have these texts, we occasionally have archaeological artifacts, so we have things from the past that we have to interpret.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that interpretation is never objective. I mean, it tries to do as much justice to the thing, but what's emerging from this interpretation is automatically a narrative, mm-hmm. and it's automatically a biased narrative. Now, of course, what we want our narrative to be is as nuanced as I said, do as much justice to the original thing as possible. It wants to be, you know, we want to do it with integrity. I think integrity is extremely important when it comes to writing history. So I believe in good history. I believe in the possible integrity of the historian. But it's impossible to give you history outside of a narrative. Mm-hmm. And that's why I do not think that one history is objectively more true than another. A certain narrative may be better than another one because it does more justice to the past, because it's written with a higher degree of integrity and detachment. So I'm a bit afraid. I mean, I think it's becoming too abstract for it's good, but
I think it's interesting. I just want to get to the core of this. But isn't that also maybe depending on, especially when it comes to the people who are communicating the narrative, is whether what is their intention when they get the text?
Yeah.
So is there a good faith analysis? Because you could either do a bad faith analysis,
absolutely,
or you could do a good faith analysis, right?
Yeah.
So I guess
exactly.
And you mentioned the word integrity. So I guess it depends on the people that are interpreting it.
Absolutely. That's exactly it. Yeah. But it's also, again, being, you know, and this in a sense is changing, I think, and I'm curious which way it will be changing, because on the one hand,
do you have a hypothesis on how it might change in the future?
Well, let's see. But the point is that we still have the old myths, if you like, and they make a great story. They make an excellent story, but does it still work for today's society in Luxembourg, which is very different, because of course the original reason of this story was to make Luxembourgers make them feel good about themselves. Well, first of all, tell them that they were Luxembourgers, and then make them feel good about themselves. And and then of course nowadays we do not have these people here who can claim, as artificial as it may be, descendants from Count Siegfried in the 10th century. So how is this going to evolve, and how is it going to evolve by having a history, an academic history production that's becoming increasingly critical, that's taking up new topics such as colonialism, which is another big thing, which is investigating, as my friend Benoît Magéo says, the financial industry and the history of that. So topics which I wouldn't call them necessarily taboo, but which weren't really being addressed in the past. What's going to be the result of this for a general vision of Luxembourg's past that I'm curious about?
Is there also the shifting of the demographic? Do you think that can also shift our narrative, because we now have a quite less Luxembourgish population, and we have a greater international population? Do you think that's also going to affect the way the narrative is going to develop in the future?
I Again, I'm curious. I don't know. You never know. But already, I mean, if you look at academic history, the role of immigration in the past has changed. You know, there has been quite a bit of research over the past 40, 50 years on immigration. And so if you look at even the more popular representations of Luxembourgish history, not all of which are being used, and maybe you should do something on social media about all that, as you suggested. You know, you do have a different view on the role immigration played for the country's past. But then, as I just said, I mean, the question is, will it trickle down? What will happen? How is it? What is it going to do? And that could be interesting. I mean, for example, I mean, we're in a situation where, I mean, Luxembourg's founding member of the European Union. Luxembourg presents itself as staunchly pro-European, even if that can be questioned again by some silly academics like myself. So on the one hand, we have this European context. At the same time, we have a European context which is itself under threat from nationalists all over the place. Now, what's happening here? We don't know. What impact will it have on the past? We don't know. But of course, you could retell, and some people do it, Luxembourg's past as always having been part of larger political frameworks, all the way until the European Union. And I find there's an interesting way of retelling the past, but it somehow fits our current times. But again, we don't know what's happening. I mean, the European Union may become a success story emulated across the globe everywhere. It could also fall apart. And this, again, may change how we're narrating the past.
So just to close this off, I think this is super interesting. Because, as you mentioned earlier, there's a huge amount of complexity when it comes to history, right? And as you mentioned, it's not always just a simple narrative, right? So whenever somebody tells you a narrative that feels good, you know, it's clean, and it seems almost too good to be true, there's probably almost always a deeper context behind it. So I think you actually pointed that out to me in the beginning when I unconsciously, I guess, picked up some of that narrative that, you know, was communicated to me. So I think this is quite helpful, and I hope people can take something away from this, you know, when it comes to, I guess, navigating or questioning the narratives or the national identity. So, yeah, I want to thank you, Pitt, very much for your time. It was very interesting.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.